Hey everyone, welcome to another Nerd Stalker. I am Adolfo Ferranda at Nerd Stalker at A Ferranda on Twitter with my co-host. Co-host? Oh, Greg froze. Perfect timing. Wonderful. Anyways, Greg will be joining us, hopefully, in a few. So I will just get the show on the road here. Time's a pressing. Okay, well, the first story comes from eWeek. And let me get it to you guys here. Boom. So digital virtual assistants. There's a ton of them right now. And oh, I think Greg is calling in. Stand by, please. Stand by, everyone. Thank you for your patience. I will hopefully edit this in post. Greg, where are you? Greg, join us, please. I think your machine crashed. He's live. Join in, Greg. Again, my apologies, everyone. We will have this resolved eventually, or the show must go on, and Greg can just... here he comes, I think. I see Greg joining the hangout. Sorry. Oh, there's Greg again. Yay, everyone. So we are live, Greg, so you know.
Yes, thank you.
Your lower third back or whatever, if you can. Yep. So I will continue where I was, you guys, with my first story of the virtual assistant thingamabobber. And,
yes.
Thanks to eWeek for this one. This one is Mike Elgin, well-known tech participant, as I like to call them, in the world of IT and tech. Yeah, so here you go. See, the virtual assistants will need a virtual manager. It was a really interesting take to me because, as Mike sort of sums up in this story, there are a slew of these sort of AI type of virtual assistant type of things that are coming out, whether it's Cortana, Siri, or you know any of the other ones, even the Amazon Echo, apparently Facebook M also. There's going to be a whole bunch of them. In fact, there are other ones too. There's children's ones. Barbie has a particular type of thing with kids that sort of pertains to this whole item too. And now there are a great deal of these. So the company's called Toy Talk, and they already created a separate virtual assistant platforms for Hello Barbie, Thomas and Friends, Talk to You platforms, two virtual reality systems for children only, and each different from the other. So they're not just for professionals, so consumers also will get these things, and they're increasingly cheaper and open source sort of APIs for developers to create these type of virtual assistant solutions for everyone too. Like a company called Aria offers roll your own virtual assistants, but requires you to supply your own data. And so we can also expect to see virtual assistant features built into apps as an interface. The main point will be the app, but the virtual assistant feature will function as the only way to interface with the app. So increasingly, you're going to see there's going to be a slew of these sort of virtual assistant items and applications sort of conflicting with each other, sort of the sum of the article when it comes to. And we're going to have so many of these things that we're eventually going to need something or someone or some sort of AI itself to sort of manage all of these items too, collectively, right? Because there's going to be all these disparate sort of solutions vying to do sort of a similar thing for us all. So it was a really interesting take, an interesting new thought on like who will that manager be, or will it be more than one, and that kind of thing, and how is that solution going to play out? So the conversation sort of begins now. So I just thought it was really an interesting sort of perspective on this whole space.
Well, it's interesting. It's part of that big conversation of integrated apps, right? You know, how do they all work together, and how do they play together? I mean, it's that same conversation, right, that we're hearing, yeah. Right? I mean, there's so many out there that, you know, how do you integrate your whole life with it?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. How does Google Calendar know about whatever, some other dinner, open table dinner or something like that type of thing?
You know, yeah. And I've been fooling around with, if then, then this, right? And or, you know,
if this
then
or that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
And I found that in some ways, that's one way I have to connect my apps together, right?
Yeah.
And we would push bullet and a couple other things.
Yeah, that that's a great analogy there, yeah.
Yeah, but it's a very good point. You need a manager to manage employees eventually.
I know. So Greg, what do we got with Ben Carson happening? Ben Carson and NASA? What?
Well, you know, the Iowa caucus is coming up, right? I have a caucus is coming up, and I kind of wanted to just talk about this. You know, he isn't at the top of the heap for the GOP, but Ben Carson had a guest blog on Recode, and thanks to Kate Nibbs from Gizmodo for this story. You know, he had a prescription for cybersecurity is really create a new organization like the National Aeronautics and Space Administration called NASA, NASA to all of us.
Oh, those guys.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, establish a National Cybersecurity Administration, NCSA. And I don't know. I was a little bit, it was interesting. And his purpose was is that, you know, he said almost anyone could also participate. So it's going down the road of what I would call the anonymous path, right? Hmm. You know, where, you know, we could get a lot of people involved in this and they could help combat this whole thing. I don't know. It's wild enough to make me think about it, but I don't know if we need another, you know, $100 billion agency in the government. But I thought it was something interesting that he said. You know, he says that you know, he doesn't have a roadmap. It's just a concept right now. But right. You know, I mean, you know,
how very Ben Carson like.
Yeah. You know, and he said the NSA is not a new federal bureaucracy. On the contrary, it's a consolidation and unification of countless and often redundant programs and niches and offices which operate disjointly throughout the government. I mean, we hear that all the time. Mm. Obama talks about that. Ben might as well talk about it too. But this new administration would, you know, his new administration would streamline the efforts into eliminating stovepipes that make America's online efforts so ineffective. So a lot of thoughts came to my mind when I was looking at this, and you know, anonymous comes to my mind. You know, $1 billion agency again that's ineffective comes to mind. So there's a lot of angles you could take on this, and I just wanted to bring it up to everyone's attention that Ben Carson is actually talking about this in cybersecurity. So
wow. Ben Carson, go figure, huh?
Well, yeah, he has presidential a prescription.
Candidate.
Sorry. Okay. Well, very let's nice. Go on to your next one, my friend.
What's sort of this piggybacking.
About? Yeah. Bosses?
Yeah, so piggybacking on Greg's story here, yeah. So turns out, thanks to, let's see, what is this? But Remaking the University, Michael Moran's Christopher Newfield's blog, it appears. This is a really interesting story that's been kind of breaking today. Today being, well, yesterday actually, Saturday and Sunday, the 30th, January 30th, as of this recording. Yeah, so UCOP ordered spyware installed on UC data networks, as you see here. So the Chronicle has discovered, you know, behind this paywall sort of story that University of UC President Janet Napolitano ordered the installation of computer hardware capable of monitoring all emails going in and out of the UC system. So UC Chief's operating officer says that, quote, you know, that UC policy forbids the university from using such data for some non-security purposes. And what's particularly nefarious also is that what's upset a lot of the faculty at the surveillance was put into place without consulting the faculty. So what's really creepy too is they say, in fact, the people installing the system were under strict instructions not to reveal it was taking place. So that's kind of gross. You know, when you realize that kind of thing has been happening, you know, something is amiss or the red flag should come up. So, They list a couple of communications between UC Berkeley faculty, one about how the faculty there came to know about the program, the other a timeline of events. And it's just really nefarious and very strange that this kind of thing was happening. You know, in the enterprise, we're used to this kind of thing, right? We sort of assume that that all of our emails and phone calls or voicemails are all, you know, stored, obviously for sort of auditing purposes and things like that, depending on the type of vertical you're in. But at the university level, it's really strange where innovation and that kind of thing is super important, and communication especially too. And where cutting edge research or whatever, especially at UC Berkeley too, could be really valuable, let's say for one particular company instead of another one.
Or country.
Or country, yeah, exactly. Or yeah, government agency, yeah, as you said, country, yeah. And But even on a lower level, it's just sort of weird, you know, that, that they're doing this. You know, I don't know. It's just, it has left me with a really bad taste in my mouth. And like I've said, whenever I see this type of, there were a lot of emails also that said confidential, do not distribute in the internal dialogue emails and things like attorney-client privilege, when in reality later she sort of turned around and said, oh, sorry, that was a mistake. I was saying that because there was no attorney-client privilege in this. And it's kind of just scaring staff to be quiet.
Oh, absolutely.
Type of thing. And then backtracking once this became increasingly public. And even the IT staff said that they felt really uncomfortable doing this too. And that had farmed out the IT work and the data to an external vendor. So a lot of these internal communications are actually leaving the UC, it appears, on this external vendor's, you know, a cloud or whatever it is, system, which is not particularly, could backfire. It could not be a good idea.
Well, especially at UC Berkeley. I mean, I mean, you know, we're not talking about a conservative organization there.
I know.
Fact that, yeah, you know, it's
that too. Yeah,
right. You know, to do it at the UC Berkeley, that's kind of incredible. But you know, I was going to ask you is that, you know, we are used to this. We kind of assume this at the enterprise or the, you know, private sector.
Yeah.
I mean, if someone doesn't even assume that, I think they would be pretty naive, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, to do it at a educational institution and. Wow.
Yeah, yeah, really strange, amazing, right? With professors, tenured professors, whatever. I don't know. So it's especially in a secretive way where you don't tell you. I mean, because even in the enterprise, they typically have you sign something saying that you acknowledge or letting you know you're being monitored, really, to sort of dissuade you from doing any sort of stupid stuff on their particular networks, right?
Right.
I shouldn't say stupid stuff that's detrimental to their business or potentially get them in some sort of legal trouble, right? But for it to do it secretly, I mean, this is really bizarre.
I see a union grievance coming.
Yeah.
as well as lawsuits and everything. So,
right. So we got speed round, right?
Speed round. All right. Let's get out of here.
Right to me.
Yes.
All right.
No. Twitter. We're trying to talk Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter. How could Twitter?
Yeah, sorry.
So I've been wanting to know this. Where did Twitter?
Well, you heard this week the Twitter stock tanked, and there was a great Twitter. So thanks to VentureBeat and Nova Spivak for this article. Interesting is that everyone's been jumping on what's wrong with Twitter. But if you think about it, Twitter has a lot of cash. I was checking into. In fact, it puts them in the top three of cash rich companies, actually.
Wow, really?
I think they're saying that in the sector, it's Yahoo has $5.9 billion in cash reserve, and Netflix has $2.3 billion. So you know, you can see where this Twitter's $3.5 billion. Ugh. So they're very cash rich, and they said, and in this article, it was kind of, they weren't really focusing on that, but they were really focusing on, what can you do to make Twitter better? You know, is it, and you see a lot of these articles after this, the stock tanked, was, you know, is Twitter relevant anymore? Is it something that, you know, is past its prime already? Mm-hmm. All those type of things. And this writer went on to kind of like say, this is how we could probably make it better. You know, and it has some, you know, if you read the list, improving the signal to noise ratio on tweets, influence metric, it has a lot of things that like these third party apps were providing through the Twitter API in the earlier days, right? Like Clout, you know, was one that I kind of think of when I was reading some of this stuff. And I just wanted to get your kind of thoughts on, you know, I use Twitter all the time, so
I've been seeing these stories. You know, a lot of, admittedly, I haven't read any of them, but just from being a Twitter user and seeing the Twitter universe and everything, they have massive, massive adoption still. So to say that they're not relevant or whatever is a gross understatement. At the same time, on the flip side of that coin, and maybe this is me, I don't see how they're making money, and I don't see how they make money. I just, perhaps from a sort of advertising kind of sponsored tweet type of thing, but those are sort of here and there. Besides that, unless there's some sort of like subscription or enterprise solution, perhaps that's just old traditional thinking on Adolfo's part. I have no idea how, you know, how you get it to 100x more profitable. That's just me though. I would love to hear their hypothetical situations, but that's just for me. Again, though, massive adoption. Adoption.
You know, they're still relevant. I think they have over 300 million, people, active users. They say,
and they're global. They're global. Yeah,
they're huge. They're global. Hey, and I'm not sure. You know, I think they've been. You know, this isn't a new issue to them. You know, we've seen features roll out over the last 2 or 3 years of trying out different things. Like I said, the sponsored tweets seem to be there. Adding video in, you know, in the earlier days of Twitter, you know, to kind of, you know, gain a little bit more traction, kind of go up against Facebook. You know, there's a lot of choices out there right now, too. I mean, you have Instagram and Facebook, you know, ways of getting information. But, I've just been using it for so long that it's just like anything else. It's part of my toolbox. Mm-hmm. And with all the other choices out there, I don't have time to go research another one to make more of my relevant social media, because it's a tool. It's like a wrench, a scissor. Sure.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, once a scissor works for me, it cuts paper. I don't need to go get 10 more scissors, you know?
Yeah. And also what's strange, you know, I've heard some people saying though too, that they're getting primed for sale actually for someone else, and that they're, that being said, they're still going to have the same amount of users. And also this whole notion of, and perhaps this is a VC notion, a venture capitalist type of notion, expecting a company to sort of hockey stick forever is, I think, unrealistic. And I think that's startups and companies, they settle sometimes where they're at. You know, sometimes there's a plateau and you can get marginal gain, but not like explosive growth anymore. And you can see this from companies like Evernote. I think a lot of this type of stuff is happening where there was like early stage expectations for these really fast adopted startups that became, I don't know so much as large as so much as just a big user base for their particular solution, but that solution didn't have tremendous profitability or something like that in terms of, like, from a VC's perspective, tremendous profitability is what I'm saying. So I think people need to reset their expectations. A company sometimes just hits a plateau. That's their limit. You know, there's only so many laundromats that you can have in a neighborhood.
Absolutely. I agree with you, Adolfo. I think that it's an interesting time, because I think you're seeing a lot of former unicorns, you know, that 1 billion valuations now shrink to 10% of what their original valuations are.
Going to what is realistic, right?
Yeah.
I think the key word here is this is realistic. So this is the way things are.
I mean, and good for, you know, people like Facebook and others who did cash out and were able to go public and you make it. I think that, you know, it's a good thing, but I think, yeah, you're right. I think Twitter has some upside, and quite frankly, at a lower valuation, they make even a better buyout target at this point. You know, so anyway, let's now go to speed round.
We used to have a fancy sound for that. That is our fancy sound.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, you're a poker player. So, and I heard you're the poker playing machine, not the
screen. Yeah, if you're looking at the Tournament of Champions champion right here. Actually, you're looking at my screen is what you're looking at, hopefully. This one kind of broke my heart. So researchers at University of Alberta have created a poker program that is unbeatable, and which wasn't very, you know, wasn't really a news story per se, because there were great, almost unbeatable poker playing AI and online computer systems. But the one that broke my heart is that this is Texas Hold'em, and this is my game, my particular flavor of poker. So the algorithm is called, as you can see, Cepheus. It's able to learn from each playing hand over hand and improving its decision making over time. What's really neat is there's an a video on this. So I would advise you guys to go check out the article of the BBC where the actual one of the lead devs on this AI is talking about it. And it, what's fascinating is that he talks about how Cepheus will learn about like sort of a bad decision it'll purposely make. It'll go all in over and over and over and over and over and learn from, oh, okay, the X amount of times it's good to go all in or it's not in this particular scenario, and then make poor decisions on purpose, poor decision, poor decision, poor decisions, mm-hmm. and then whittle that poor decisions sort of ratio down to the point of what's optimal poor decision making, you know, what's realistically, which is minimal, and then it can get to a near perfect state. And so when playing against a human, although there is a very slim margin of error, a human would view this particular AI that you're playing against as a perfect player because it is that good. So it's real fascinating. Go check it out. The BBC news here, the unbeatable poker playing machine. And my heart is broken now because computers have won officially. This is the first takeover.
Yeah, I don't, you know, don't go to the table with that guy. That's all I got to tell you. Yeah, don't go to the table with that guy. All day long. Good one. Speed round.
Kids.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you to the Space Foundation for their release on this. But the Space Foundation just announced the 6th annual student art winners of the Space Foundation Student Art Contest. And check it out on our channel. I think it's interesting what I was thinking and Adolfo and I are both parents. You know, I'm just amazed by the imaginations a lot of kids and how they express themselves in art. And so I just had to post this because I was just, when I was looking through the art, my jaw just dropped. I was just like going like, whoa, really? And I think if you could scroll down some of the pictures there, I appreciate it.
What's really neat too about this is they've included everyone. I mean, it's public, private school, homeschool kids. It's really neat.
Yeah. And they had a lot of entries from around the world, 40 countries, I think they said. So, I mean, the fact that, we still have kids thinking about space.
Malaysia,
Bangladesh.
Wow.
I know, dude. I mean, and it's interesting. I think there was one that kind of reminded me of like Abraham Lincoln thinking about that. Space or something like that. Yeah, that was very colorful, very bright, very Serena. Positive.
Serena gets my pick. Wow, that one's awesome. Yeah. I love this one from India.
Isn't it cool?
Awesome. Yeah, isn't it very cool? Very creative.
Yeah, so and it's interesting as the kids get older and the development of their art as well, in terms of just context and expression.
Really neat.
Jeez, I mean, I couldn't do this crap when I was 9 or 10 years old.
Yeah, I
sucked at this.
Write my name still.
Yeah, well, I think stick figures were about my pace.
Wow,
so, isn't that cool? awesomeness, but. But yeah, anyway, check it out on our channel. Appreciate it. Next time it comes around, parents, why don't you sign your kid up to this if they have any. Creative bent at all, even just a little bit, it'll encourage them to express themselves. So.
Excellent.
Mitsubishi.
So this is Mitsubishi came out with something called the Sea Aerial, which turns fountains into antennas.
What?
Yeah, so crazy. So it turns out, this is nothing new. They've been doing this for a while initially, but the problem was that. The thing, the spigot that the Navy's been fiddling with this a long time ago, the spigot had to be above water. And so that was sort of particularly difficult. And the spray too was problematic because it was inconsistent in terms of a signal. But anyways, when someone mentions radio aerial, it tends to conjure up a vision of something made of steel and wire. But what about one made of water, right? On Thursday, the Mitsubishi Electric Corporation unveiled its Sea Aerial, which uses a column of seawater sprayed into the air to create a radio transceiver antenna designed for use at sea or along shorelines. It's billed as the world's first seawater antenna capable of receiving digital terrestrial broadcasts. In our day-to-day lives, we're used to dealing with radio frequencies that are so short and relatively strong that the transceiver antenna on our devices are correspondingly tiny. However, as radio frequencies get longer and the signals become weaker, the antenna has to be longer as well. So So this gets kind of kooky here, right? So the fact means that many radio installations require very large antenna that are expensive, time-consuming to build, and far from portable. Mm. On the other hand, if an antenna could be made out of water, you could have an aerial the size of Geneva's Jet Adir in the time it takes to fire up the pump. When it came time to move the installation, it would simply be a matter of switching off the water and moving the electronics to another location. What's really interesting, though, to me is why seawater, right? So,
yeah, exactly.
And not garden variety freshwater. Contrary to popular belief, pure water is a poor, very poor conductor of electricity.
Ah, makes sense.
It's the mineral irons dissolved in that actually carry the current. So for practical purposes, seawater works best for making the watery antenna. And and so it turns out the innovation, what Mitsubishi is really doing here, is it has an insulated nozzle that transmits the radio signal to the saltwater plume. And according to the company, inside the nozzle is a quarter wavelength tube of insulated material that physically separates the plume from the surrounding water and maintains the circuit. Another factor is that the sea aerial design is that though the saltwater can conduct electricity, it's much less conductive than metals, which translates into poor efficiency as an antenna material. Mitsubishi claims that by running computer simulation, it was able to determine the ideal plume diameter, allowing for a 70% increase in efficiency. So Mitsubishi is also working on other conductive and transmutative liquids as new antenna materials and has applied for a register for sea aerial as a trademark. So really fascinating stuff, really weird that you can have like this exact sort of plumage of the water that plays into this, an insulated nozzle type of technology also, and that this thing is just an antenna in general. But clever.
Awesome. Awesome. Clever. Very clever. Well, yeah, I guess we'll turn our fountains into antennas soon. So yeah. anyway, next. All right. Well, we'll have a maker thing, a hack for you guys. How to hack a Teddy Ruxpin to say everything you type or tweet. So, I thought that was just kind of cool. I mean, I kind of, you know, I came from the era where Teddy Ruxpin was available. And, you know, I think Adolfo hugged him very closely in his bed.
When he was, yeah, a lot of yeah, Ruxpin.
Yeah. So anyway, the guys at Chip, you know, the $9 computer at Nexthink Company decided to hack Teddy Ruxpin and actually Teddy Ruxpin had like a tape driver in the back with those signals, it moved his mouth and everything and basically it read you stories and all that stuff. So they hacked it so that they're able to actually put all that was recordings or whatever stories onto the $9 computer. And basically also, since it's Wi-Fi enabled, they decided to make it, speak tweets. and you've seen these Twitter tweets all the time. So I'm thinking like, I wonder if I could go on eBay, pick up a Teddy Ruxpin and start hacking him and then have him do this and talk tweets to me all day. Right next to me. I'll put it in my backpack going to work, you know, bring it with me, my little buddy right next to me. Talking to man. Yeah, it's pretty funny, but you can see what they did originally and how they actually modified it and updated. But I'd love to, you know, and Maker Faire is coming up in May, so we're, you know, these little hacks are just encouraging other people to kind of take old toys and make them new again.
You bring your Teddy Ruxpin back to life. Yeah.
Okay. Tips of the week.
Tip time.
Yes.
All right, so my first tip, as many of you may or may not know, so I'm a big fan of Agile and Kanban type of things, and you guys can Google that and the meaning of that, basically a Toyota sort of manufacturing type of practice. And I use a particular free tool called Trello, which is amazing at Trello.com. You can go check it out to create your own sort of Kanban boards, free, unlimited amount of them. But if you're not so inclined to have your stuff hosted in the cloud or via Trello sort of stuff, you can do it locally now with this solution called Skady or Scotty, however you pronounce it. It's at getscotty.com. That's GETSKADI. I probably should do this at the end. .com. So as you can see here, it's it has all the typical sort of Kanban things, and all you have to do is run this particular command line right here that they give you, and it will install on your machine. So it's Linux and OS X supported, and Windows apparently is coming soon. But as you can see, it sort of has this very Trello-like look where you have your various swim lanes that you can name. Here you can name your different swim lanes here, your columns, if you will. And then you can add your particular tasks or stories, depending on how you what sort of practice you're sort of doing. And then you can move these, you can drag these guys over to, you know, the different columns too. It's just for the typical sort of Kanban flow. Very simple, very cool that you can do it locally now too. And apparently they have a free cloud solution, of course. It's getskadi.com, skadi.com, G-E-T-S-K-A-D-I.com.
Nice. Good tip. Wow. Mr. Kanban. We appreciate you. All right, let's go to the next tip. Oh, Google Maps. How many times that you go in and out of Wi-Fi or you don't want to use your 4G limit of data, and but you just want to get from A to B, you know, in a new city, new town that you're visiting, you know, you're on a business trip or whatever. So thanks to Independent and Doug Bolton for this, but, you know, I've seen this feature. I just never tried it before. You could actually use Google Maps offline. And what he'll say in this article, if you guys check this out.
I've never done that. I got to do that. I don't think I even know how to. But
No. You basically could download maps onto your smartphone. And, you know, it makes sense these days. You know, your smartphone has a lot of space. But it's a maximum of 250 megabytes or basically 120 square kilometers in area. You like that? So, you know, you won't, you know, if you're living in San Francisco, you won't get the whole United States, but you'll get a good selection for like Super Bowl if you want to get from different places, different venues.
Yeah, I mean, your driving range, that's perfect for that kind of thing, right?
Oh, exactly. And so, you know, check it out. It's a great tip. I've seen this before. I just haven't tried it myself either.
Yeah.
But it just reminded me that this is a great thing to have. You know, you could throw paper away completely at this point, right? How many times people used to just say, oh, I'll just print out the Google map, right? Or something that, you know? So anyway, check this out. It's a great way of actually seeing new places without having to have connectivity. So
Nice tip.
Yeah. All right, bro. Let's go to yours.
Readable. So what's funny about this, or maybe not funny, is like recently, a couple of days ago, or maybe last week, actually, Evernote sent an email that they were discontinuing several services in lieu of their new CEO and their streamlining that they're doing. I know that Clearly, unfortunately, has been killed, and which sort of pertains to this particular story. There was another one, too. I know the food thing was killed, which I didn't really care about. And Sketch actually was killed on several devices, iOS and mobile devices, but it still lives on in OS X. But so I'm trying to address all those apps, so looking for alternatives for all those things, one of which here, oddly enough, is Readable. So and it's funny because when you go to the Readable website, it's actually what Clearly became. So it says, it's actually the developer from Readable saying, I have some exciting news. Evernote has acquired Readable. way back when. So luckily, this website still lives in this JavaScript type of thing where you can just drag it to your bookmarks and it works. So what Readable does, it'll be this announcement here and you'll ask yourself, oh no, where's Readable? I'm on this page and I don't see the application or whatever it is, right? The bookmarklet actually at readable.tastefulwords.com. But what you do see is this little teeny green thing down here that says show setup. Yeah. So if you're down at the bottom of the page, that is what you want to click. Boom. And then look what you get. You get this whole slew of sort of solutions. I opted for a theme where you can get different themes, and it'll show you, just like Clearly used to work, because this was what Clearly was based on, how your page will look. So if we go to a certain page, we would just drag this, you know, once we either set our custom items, which is awesome, you can do, or just select a canned theme so you don't have to deal with any of this. Once you get this guy Readable and you drag it to your bookmarklet, it'll function just like Clearly does, making the page readable so that you don't have to be distracted by anything that you're reading on a particular web page. But I would love if people out there have any other solutions that they prefer instead of Clearly. This is just what Clearly was based on, and it works for now. That would be great. So
nice.
Readable.tastefulwords.com. Nice. Check it out.
Ooh. You've been doing some hiking lately, I surmise.
Yes, and so I must track my miles. No, I'm just kidding. So segue into MileIQ, MileIQ.com. It's an app, a free app, I believe. Yeah, where you can do automatic detection, one swipe classification for mileage and logging. These guys were a startup that was acquired by Microsoft, and I know that they are in the Twitter building now in San Francisco, and very, very popular app now, especially with any type of consultants or anyone that's doing any kind of driving or traveling in any way that needs to log it automatically. It does that really elegantly, and it'll provide you, you know, your dollars feature too, and that kind of thing, so that if you need to expense this type of stuff. So this works really good for photographers, people like Greg who you know, need to expense their stuff, their videography, which I will never pay. I mean, I will pay for. And wait, you didn't get that on film, did you? And so yeah, you see mileage deduction and that kind of stuff. So check them out. They're all nice. Platforms, basically web, of course, mobile, pretty standard stuff. Really neat solution. MileIQ, look into it for your mileage solutions.
That's cool.
So let's see the final tip that I have here, I believe, is entrepreneur tools. And what's I love about this is I'll put the URL's crazy, but just Google entrepreneur tools and perhaps Muhammad or something or Zeef, and you'll get it. So you'll see on this page there's a slew of stuff this guy has sort of compiled, and there's a few of these type of websites, but this one's really neat, of solutions for an entrepreneur, perhaps a single individual or whatever developer that wants to start a company. And as you scroll down, you'll see all these different sort of categories, right? So prototyping, startup tools, product launch sort of tools, list by others, hosted website building, app development tools, and you go down, startup community, online stores and shopping carts, finding co-founders. It's really helpful. Payment solutions, ideation, market creation, mind mapping tools, a really neat list. I love it. It kind of brings me back to the day of when people would compile a lot of lists online, of these web pages, where you could just bookmark these things and you just had a sort of a go-to for various things, pitching, decision-making. It just goes on. Look how far it goes down. It's crazy. And it's a lot of really helpful information here. So check it out, Entrepreneur Tools by Muhammad Kihani.
Oh, that's so great.
And there's a ton of info.
Oh, good job, man. Good job. That's great. Great thing. Wow. Okay, I guess we'll move on to events, huh?
Woohoo!
Okay, well, I talked to Miles Weisslater, the founder and CEO of SF Newtek, and it looks like they have a new, for 2016, they have a new Food Bites program, and it's going to start in Brooklyn, New York, believe it or not. And that's coming up on March 3rd. So if you have you foodie tech guys or food tech guys are in New York, or in that vicinity, go check out Food Bites at Brooklyn. You go to the website there, and they have San Francisco coming up on June 6th, and they also have Denver, Colorado coming up in the fall. So it's a pretty big schedule of three Food Bites events sponsored by Rabobank. Yeah, so they're all sponsored by Rabobank, and so Miles and his crew is always busy with that, and we hope to help them get the word out. So
nice, Food Bites. B-Y-T-S-E, very clever.
Yes.
Like bites.
Yes.
All right, Greg, well, where can we get more information about you?
Oh, you reach me at socialgreg@nerdstalker.com, and also you could also reach me on Twitter @socialgreg. So, you know, where can we get a hold of you, Adolfo, my friend?
Adolfo, you can get me at adolfo@nerdstalker.com. If you want to email me, I'm @aferonda at Twitter, @nerdstalker. You can always reach us. And thank you everyone for watching and listening out there. And we really greatly appreciate it.
Yeah. If you like this video podcast, please like us on the YouTube and other channels that are hearing or listening or viewing us on. So we'd appreciate that. That'll help our Adolfo's ego quite a bit.
Oh, my ego doesn't need any help. I'm the guy who's drinking out of a bulletproof cup. This was an old one that actually says KY your life. It used to say upgrade your life or something like that. It's missing the R, and I don't know where the K came from. So So I'm pretty secure in that department.
Okay, my friend. Thank you. Thanks again. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Be careful out there. Have a good one.